Hey guys, thanks for joining me for this 30th episode in Season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. Special guests for this episode include author Ryan Foland, actually co-author of the book Drop the Act. We'll also visit with country singer and songwriter from New York, Ken Wilber. Got some current singles we'll be talking about, also an upcoming summer album release as well. Of course, if you would, please take the time to subscribe, drop a like, comment, leave some feedback, and of course, share with your friends. Well, someone recently asked professional chefs for the top cooking mistakes that us average Joes are making, and my question is, does cereal really count as cooking? Well, anyway, here are the highlights. Number one, don't use dull knives. You're actually more likely to cut yourself with a dull knife, so sharpen those babies up and then just be extra careful. Number two, stop cutting your vegetables unevenly. Now, if you take the time to cut them evenly, they'll cook more evenly as well. Number three, don't leave a huge mess of pots and pans. You can knock out some of those dishes during prep, so it's not so overwhelming at the end. Number four, taste everything as you go and adjust if something doesn't taste right. That way, there's still time to fix it. And number five, stop constantly checking your food in the oven, because opening the door lets heat fly out and your oven actually has to preheat all over again. We love talking with authors, especially when they're talking about ways to make differences, make your life better. And we've got an author with a brand new book called Ditch the Act, Reveal the Surprising Power of the Real You for Greater Success. I got it all out. We've got Ryan Foland on the line with us, and I think I got close to the name, didn't I, Ryan?
Yeah, you got that right on spot, Ryan. You got it.
Well, Ryan, first off, thank you for your time, and tell us a little bit about what made you know you needed to sit down and put the words to paper in this book that is truly making some changes in folks' lives as well.
Yeah, well, initially we had publishers knocking on our door, which doesn't happen all the time, and they had seen the traction that my co-author and I were getting when it comes to just building an online presence, getting featured in publications, creating a nice community online. And they were curious if we would be able to share what we were up to. So, of course, we put together exactly what we think would work and put the proposal together. And they looked at it and said, thanks, but no thanks. Everything you're saying here is what people already know. And if you're going to write a book, you'll find that it is key to write something that is new and novel, no pun intended. But what we really did is that gave us an excuse to look back at what within our success was the root factor. And it was a really interesting experiment because for me personally, there was a long time where I did not get traction and I was faking it until I made it. I was writing blogs, offering my speaking services for free. I was on all the social media platforms, but I got very little traction. And it was only when I started to show that things weren't as planned that people actually started to connect and resonate. And so we ended up calling this sort of magic element the act of ditching the act. And I think that in business, especially online, there's this pressure to showcase your highlight reel and only post the pictures where you look as good as you can and, you know, hold back everything that's not going to paint you in a positive light. And that's really not the way to get ahead because you blend in with everyone else who's trying to do the exact same thing. And in life, it actually creates a lot of distance because maybe you're different around your friends. Maybe you're different around your family. Maybe when you're around your boss, you're a whole different personality. And there are people that are put into mental institutions for less personalities than most of us have on a daily basis. And so what we really stitched everything back to was when you share your journey and your process and the behind the scenes and you let people know that you're actually imperfect and that you're just like them, it's easier for them to get to know you. And when people get to know you, they make the choice of whether or not they like you. And it's okay if not everybody likes you. And if they get to know you and they like you, then it sets the foundation for trust. And that's the magic, because people want to do business with those that they know, like, and trust. But if all you do is put on an act, and then as soon as the camera goes off, you're like, whew, you know, there's a disconnect. So it really takes a lot of pressure off of what type of content to create and how you're going to do this. Because at the root, it's like you're just being more true to yourself, and you're sharing more of the process along the way.
And Ryan, obviously you're going to have the folks that don't like you, but that's okay. And does that sometimes become a stumbling block whenever you start seeing maybe followers dropping and you start being, well, maybe I should be that fake? Is do you think maybe that's part of the reason people do that?
Well, I think the real reason is people have trepidation about putting themselves out there for who they really are, because their fear of judgment, the fear of judgment, the fear of what people think, the fear of how people perceive them. But the reality is that if all you're doing is showing the highlight, then it's very surface level, and people's BS meter goes off, and they click around and try to find out who you are as a person, and there just isn't that connection. But when you start to let people know if you're a dog or a cat guy, or if you enjoy the ocean, or when you're not working, you're doing whatever else it is, it gives people a chance to see themselves in your story. So, you know, I talk about not everybody has to like you, but in reality, I mean, there are, like, think in your social sphere. There's people who you're really close with, and there's people who you know, and there's people who you know, but maybe don't necessarily like, or you don't necessarily spend time with if you have the opportunity to. And if you peel back those layers, the people that you know the most, you know the good, the bad, and the ugly. And as soon as they tell you that they're feeling down, you're there to help support them. You're there to bring them out of that funk. And so what we don't realize is that being vulnerable doesn't show weakness. Being vulnerable gives people a chance to be involved in your life, to feel like they're contributing, to not just be a follower, but contribute to what you're doing.
Now, after getting the nose, was it hard to keep moving forward with that dream or that goal of the book publishing? Was it something you guys put on the back burner for a little while, or was it something that at that point you knew you had to do something?
No, we turned the burner stayed on. We actually turned it up, and it was just a good reminder that, you know, it's one thing to call yourself an expert, and a lot of people do. It's another thing to share your experience so that people can see your expertise. And I think that's an interesting distinction to make, because we all have amazing life experiences that have gotten us to where we are, that have made us the people that we are. But a lot of times we don't share those parts of the puzzle, right?
That's right. Now, whenever it comes to those uncomfortable shares, is there like a right or wrong as what's too far, maybe?
Absolutely. And that's one of the challenges that people face, is what to share, what not to share. We talk about it in levels of exposure. And we have five levels of exposure. The first being very low level, like the lowest level possible. You know, an example might be losing your AirPods, which happened to me 2 weeks ago, and then I found them at my desk where they should be. They'd just fallen in between desks, and they were hanging on the charger. Now that's not something that, like, I would normally think to, hey, I'm going to go out there and sort of this. If you lose something, you don't get to share it. But I shared a tweet and took a picture where I found them, which is right in front of my face. I had more engagement, more comments, people telling me what they lost. Oh my gosh, this happened to me. One lady lost it in her purse. You know, there's like, it allows this way to connect on the little levels. I spilled coffee over some of my electronics the other day, and I shared that. Now, I could have been like, oh, damn, I'm not going to share this with the world. I'm going to hide it. But do you know how many people spill stuff all over their electronics? And now we have this bond. So level one is really small, stupid, silly stuff that you might share with a friend that is just like, you're just chit-chatting, right? It gives people a chance to share their own side. Level two is more about sharing relationship challenges or things with other people, because we all interact with other people. Level three would be more serious, some major setbacks, disappointments that you're facing or that are happening. Level four, like the big stuff. You know, for me personally, I got a DUI and I hid it for 15 years of my life. I was so ashamed of it. It was like, it was my scarlet letter that nobody could see. And it wasn't until I shared it that all of a sudden people were like, it's okay. It became this way for us to connect. Now that was really hard for me to share, but now I share that and I share how it's changed the way that I live. I also filed for bankruptcy only to have it returned with 32 cents short on postage. And this was something that I would have never told anybody. But as soon as I had the courage to start to share that, people realized that I've been in a really bad financial situation, and most of us have, and there's another piece of connective tissue. So it's not about just going, hey, I heard this radio interview with Ryan and Cameron, I'm just going to go emotionally vomit on all of my social media feeds. No. You know, if you do that, if you just jump to level four, people are going to think that, you know, they're going to hit the report button and make sure you get some help. It's about warming up your audience with level ones. It's about throwing in level twos when it makes sense. It's maybe about incorporating level threes into some of your content. Maybe if you're on a podcast and you're brave enough, you build up and share level four. And that's when you get real. That's when people really get to know you. And then level five. Wait. Level five is what not to share. Level five is what not to share. It's just as important. Do not share when you're in the heat of the moment, right? It's the same idea where you're not going to email somebody that you're angry with. Maybe you draft an email and you wait till tomorrow. So in the moment can get you in trouble. You also want to stay away from politics and religion and divisive things that you know there's pretty much you're either going to associate with a certain side or another side. It's very polarizing. So obviously any type of racial, any type of misogynistic, any type of aggressive, anything like that, you really want to stay away from. On my Twitter, there's a zero politics and a zero trolling policy. And just, you can create your own positive environments. Now, if you are a politician, granted, you can talk about that. If you're an activist and it's something that's special to you, that's fine. But just know you're going to get just as many people who are going to, you know, be upset at that issue, or they're going to fight back at that issue, then there will be positive. So as long as you're aware of it.
Now, in the writing process, what was the writing process for you? Is this the first publication that you've put out, the first writing experiment, if you will?
Yes. And thankfully, my business partner and co-author at the time, who, funny story, if I'm fully disclosing Ditching the Act, once the book went live and the pandemic hit, there were some core differences in our values and belief systems. So he's gone on to his amazing things and I've gone on to my amazing things. But what's interesting about that is I'm not afraid of sharing that. And that's a whole nother chapter in the story. Now, if we rewind to writing the book, he's a stronger writer, I'm the stronger speaker, and we had this nice yin and yang. We did hire professionals to help us learn how to approach the writing. And the biggest benefit we had from having an outside view is learning a process that is proven that worked. And it can be as simple as what is called mini chapters. You see, when you start to write and you're into these deep chapter one and two, it can take so long. So the first thing we did was we really did a full day of exploratory. And we really just like got all of our ideas out there. Then we created really what was a full outline of the entire book. Every chapter, every story we wanted to talk about, places where we needed research, people that we wanted to feature. And we structured the book in three parts. We wanted to share our story to lead by example. We wanted to show why it was important to ditch the act, examples and research and case studies. And then we wanted to show exactly how you do it. So in a structure of setting by example, showing why it's important, and then how to do it, we really just outline. And then every day for months and months, we just would connect online and use it. Build everything out accordingly.
Now, what was your takeaway from the first writing experience? Did it light a fire? We've used that before. Did it light a fire for future works, or did it maybe let you know this is a one and done?
No. It's a joke in the world of authors that your first book really doesn't matter. It's your second book that does. And so I came into this process knowing that this would be a great opportunity to start. And I've actually contacted the publisher and they are interested in the sequel, which I'm going to be writing this time with my wife. And it is called Ditch the Pitch. So you've got Ditch the Act, which is about being authentic and really showing how the more imperfect you are, the more people can relate. And ditch the pitch is all about, you know, getting what you want without pitching. People know when you're trying to pitch them services. People know when you're trying to, get them to do something. And the best thing you can do is not pitch them. Ditch the pitch and really try to engage them for what they're after, asking questions, being strategic. And this is something that I've done and spoken on for years, based on a methodology I created called the 313, where it boils down what you want to say into three sentences, one sentence, and three words. So we're all a little wordy, I think, even myself, as I listen to myself go on and on. So the less you talk, the more people ask questions. And when people ask questions, then you find out what they're interested in, and you can help deliver information and value accordingly. So yes, the sequel is the book proposal is being written now.
And you talk about the questions and the answers. Are there are there hidden meanings in some of those questions that you got to watch out for as well?
I think the hidden gem is in stopping your talk and making other people ask questions based on their interests. So I think that when you talk past the sale, when you dominate the conversation, when you're not letting somebody else participate, they won't have a chance to ask their questions. And I think we just bulldoze people with too much information.
That's right. Well, if folks want to find more information about Ditch the Act and Ditch the Pitch coming hopefully soon, where's the best place to find all that information, Ryan?
Well, I'll ask you. The book is Ditch the Act. What do you think the website would be? If you were a guest, if you were a betting man, what do you think the website would be?
DitchTheAct.com.
Boom. There you go. So DitchTheAct.com. Now, let's get crazy and let's go one step further. If you want to find more about me, we know my name is Ryan. And if you're trying to find me online, what do you think that website would be?
RyanFolan.com.
You can find me there. I made sure to grab that. But even easier, because who knows how to spell Folan, right? Especially
right.
When you just hear it on the radio in Oklahoma and you're like, oh, it's Ryan.online. If you want to find me online, you just go to Ryan.online. So I'm easy to find. You know, I'm usually tweeting if I'm not speaking, if I'm not sailing. But the one thing I want to leave people with is the fact that when it comes to success, whatever success is for you, successful people are not doing what everyone else cannot do. Successful people are doing what everyone can do, but not everyone does. And that's in the small habits daily.
That is right. Well, Ryan, I do appreciate that's the gem right there. I appreciate you hanging it on till the last moment. Ryan, of course, like you mentioned, follow him online on all the socials as well. And Ryan, great to visit with you today. I'm looking forward to checking out, delving deeper, I should say, into the book as well. And hopefully we can talk again real soon.
Yeah. Well, hey, if you don't mind, I'll just quickly wrap this up here, which is more of an actual wrap. Because here is the deal. Let me give it to you real. The key to connection is to learn to reveal, because you are not perfect and neither am I. And that is the exact reason that we see eye to eye, because you are never perfect and we are all the same. To be perfect and the imperfect is how you win the game. So when you learn to ditch the act and learn to be yourself, you'll open up connections and the world will reveal itself.
Well said. Word.
Thank you, buddy. Word. Hey, well, this has been fun talking, and a challenge to everybody, and an easy way to ditch the act. The next time somebody asks you, how's it going? I dare you to tell the truth. Is if you just default to good, great, grand, yeah, things are great, then you're not opening up. You're not telling them what's really going on, and you're not giving them the opportunity to support you or to help you out. So when somebody asks how you're doing, I dare you to be honest and actually tell them how you're doing.
That's good stuff. Well, Ryan, again, thank you for your time, and look forward to catching up again real soon.
Word.
Well, you know what makes me better looking? Hiding as much of my face as possible. If you've seen any of the videos online, you understand. Well, the new survey asked people if they think that wearing a mask makes them look better than they do without one, and 16% of people say yes, it does. That includes 14% of men and 17% of women, and the younger you are, the more likely you are to believe that's true. Now, 29% of people say they look equally good with or without a mask, and 23% of people say they look worse in a mask. Well, in other news, Oreo. You know, they decided a couple years back to start cranking out just whatever random flavor they could think of. Well, it turns out that they're not just doing it because they're, well, freshmen in college experimental phase. You remember that, right? Well, according to some industry experts, when those random flavors come out, they'll sell pretty well, but traditional Oreos sell even better. Now, sales of regular Oreos have jumped 22% since they started regularly pumping out new flavors. Now, they believe it's because the new flavors are basically free advertising for original Oreos, and they make people remember how much they like Oreos. And if you ever forget how much you like Oreos, there's other things you might want to get checked. Our next guest here on the podcast is Ken Wilber, country singer and songwriter from the home of country music, the state of New York. That's where most people think of when they think country music, right, Ken?
Absolutely. I mean, this is where I think of when I think of country music.
Now, is country music becoming a little more recognized up north than it was in previous years, if you will?
Oh, country music is huge in New York. Now, I'll preface this whole thing by saying, you know, when you tell people that you're from New York, the first thought that they have is like the Ace Picante commercial there where New York City. It's a big state. I live in upstate New York, which is quite rural. Lots of farmers. We're in between Binghamton and Albany. And, you know, country music is very, very popular in upstate New York. I grew up listening to it. I knew lots of folks who listen to it. We tend to have, you know, a lot of country music and bluegrass festivals and whatnot around here. It's pretty big.
Now, Ken, for you, I was telling you before we came on, I was listening to the music again and getting a little bit of a vibe. Where did you get the blues into the country? I mean, I feel a little blues vibe there. Where did you get that inspiration?
Well, first off, thank you, because that's, you know, definitely something I want to go for. But I grew up listening. I mean, I grew up in a very conservative religious household. And I was initially only allowed to listen to country music and gospel music. So as I got older, I started branching off, and I'm a humongous record collector. So one of my favorite games to play with music is to find an artist that I really, really like. Like, for instance, you know, Merle Haggard or Willie Nelson, something like that. And then I want to find out who they liked. So then I'm just going to keep going down the rabbit hole and, you know, until you end up to, you know, Jimmy Rogers and Django Reinhardt and all that stuff. So I got very much into people like Ray Charles and Etta James and B.B. King, and it just kind of went all over from there. So there's a lot of blues music in me. I've always loved the blues. I've always loved jazz. I'm just a big melting pot of all kinds of different stuff.
You fit the New York vibe well, then.
I hope so.
Now, Ken, where did the story of your background kind of sound like the story of my life? Country music, Christian music, you stray from that, you're in trouble, you know. But so I understand the background. Where did music first originate in your life? When did you know you had a gift, if you will?
Well, I think from an early age, I mean, we're talking 4 or 5 years old. I just idolized anybody who was singing. I loved it. My family members would kind of recount stories about that. I used to stand in front of my grandmother's record player and just stare at it as the record was playing and just try to absorb it and understand what was happening. And then, you know, in later years, I would try to emulate whoever it was that I was listening to and trying to sound just like him. So, you know, mostly I tried to sound like Conway Twitty. That was a big one. He was a favorite of mine growing up.
You didn't like any Mark Chestnut at all, did you?
Oh, heck, I like Marquette.
I could hear the Conway. I could hear a little Mark in a couple of your songs as well. So I can hear those influences. And for you to have people be able to pick those influences out of The Voice, I mean, how cool is that for you to know that you're paying homage to those that you loved before?
Well, I mean, that's phenomenal. And I think it's something that, you know, I don't want to get too political into the how music is going today, but I think, you know, as an artist, I can speak for myself and I won't speak for anyone else, but I'll say that I really feel it's very important in any genre of music. You got to go out and you got to do your own thing. You can't be a carbon copy of anybody else, but at the same time, you need to dance with who brought you. And, you know, country music is so many things to so many different people, but we can never forget where it came from. That's very important. So, you know, we can take it all off in different directions and all that, but we need to also maintain a certain level of, you know, the traditional nature of what made country music what it is to begin with. And so to be able to pay homage to anybody who has influenced me, you know, musically, I think that's great. If you can hear that, that's wonderful. That's exactly what I want. I want you to be like, wow, this sounds fresh and new, but yet there's something in there that really kind of brings out a memory or a feeling that triggers you to think about, you know, someone who came before me.
Now, when was the time that you stepped on the stage that you knew that the stage was a whole different place than just singing pick up with church or with the family?
Well, you know, I mean, I think like most country singers, I started singing in church. That was probably my first exposure to it. And then, you know, when I got into school, I got into chorus and all that. And I loved performing. And, you know, obviously you're with, you know, the whole entire choir. You're not up there by yourself, but I still enjoyed it. And then somewhere around probably 10th grade, I got involved in theater. And theater is what really lit the bug for me. You walk out on stage and it just suddenly, I was like, whoa, this is definitely what I want to do. I want to be a performer.
Now, Ken, I know you've got three singles that have been released, and for you in 2020 to be able to see that you had three singles out, even in the whole year, much less, how cool is that to say that you had new music out there in spite of what was going on in the world?
Oh, we were very lucky to be able to do that, and it feels great to be able to put out new music. We were very fortunate in that we had started recording all this material and all the stuff that's going to be on my upcoming album, Ran Out of Sky, that'll be out this summer. We had started recording all that before the pandemic really hit, so we had done all the tracking of all the instruments and everything in Ocean Way at Nashville. So this was, you know, when we had the big groups of people together to do all this. So we had all these instrument tracks in the can ready to go. And then it was just a matter of me getting back to Nashville and recording my vocals and doing the harmonies and stuff. So we were able to keep the groups very small when we did this. And it just worked out really well. We were able to finish the project despite the pandemic.
And I know one of the singles co-written by the producer and working with Sonny Lemaire, of course, folks know him from Exile and so many other things over the years. What have you been able to pick out from Sonny? How has he impacted maybe your vision, if you will?
Oh, I think Sonny has definitely impacted my vision, and he's helped to very much shape me as an artist. You know, I tell this story all the time. The first time that I went to Nashville to record with Sonny and Tony Cotro, who was the co-producer and engineer on the project, the two of them, you know, they kind of, I almost want to frame it as like it was an audition, you know. So they ran me through the paces, and they did a lot of things to try to get me out of my comfort zone and to push me into completely changing my voice and sounding completely different than I did, and all kinds of stuff. Just, you know, I think more than anything to see A, if I could do it, and B, how I would respond to being given a task that was, you know, very difficult. You know, would I be a jerk about it? Would I get frustrated and take my ball and go home? Or would I just give it the old college try and see what happens? So, you know, our relationship has definitely evolved. The first session that I did with them, we actually have gone back and re-recorded the vocals now because we all have gotten to know each other. We're very comfortable with each other. We have a great working relationship. And I said to him, I said, listen, you know, I mean, I'm happy with how that stuff sounds, but it wasn't really a representation of me. It was me trying to sound like what you guys were telling me to do at the time. And I'm very happy that I was able to do that. It put me out of my comfort zone and taught me to do something that I hadn't done before, but now I want to go back and make it my own. And they were all about that. And we were all really happy with how things turned out with the new vocals. And now it's great. You just go in and they coach you, they help you out. I guess the biggest thing with Sonny and Tony that I'd have to say is that they push you to get performances that you don't know that you're capable of giving. You know, there are times when you're like, man, I don't know about doing this song. There's a couple of notes in this thing that are really, really just killer. And I don't know about this. I don't think that maybe it's just a little out of my range. Maybe we should drop it down a step or whatever. And they're like, nope, nope, nope. Get in there and do it. And by the time you're done, you did it. And it's such a great feeling of achievement when you accomplish something that you didn't think you could.
Now the those three singles we talked about, they're totally different in just basically every way, Ken. And for you, I wanted to give a chance to talk about the singles individually. I guess we'll just start let's do alphabetically. Is that best?
Yeah. For me.
Bread on the Table is one. Tell us a little bit about the behind the story on this one and how it first came to you, if you will.
All right. Well, Bread on the Table is an Exile cover. They did that on, I believe it was their People Get Ready EP, which is phenomenal. And it was basically just, you know, along with everything else that we ended up recording, Sonny LaMare sent me a huge pile of demo tapes and said, okay, you know, let's start picking out some stuff for your session. And to be honest with you, with the exception of maybe three or four songs, we ended up cutting everything. This song definitely jumped right out at me pretty quickly. It has a nice 90s country feel. I think that's something, in my personal opinion, that is missing from country music today, is that kind of, you know, honky tonk line dancing feel. And this song definitely has that. At the time that we recorded the song, I don't think that it had as much meaning as it does now. But, you know, now that we're in the midst of this whole global pandemic and everything, and millions of people are out of work and all kinds of stuff like that, the whole notion of, you know, worrying about whether you're going to put food on the table or pay the cable bill or the light bill or what you're going to do when your kids get sick and all this stuff, I think it resonates more now than it did at the time. So it's a wonderful song. I love the sound of it, and we're very happy that we were able to get a cut on it.
And Freedom Song, was that one of the ones that was released at the same time, or was this a previous release?
Freedom Song was one that was released right at the same time. We went to digital with that, and then we've now gone to radio with Freedom Song. So that's on radio. That actually is yet another cover, although at the time that I recorded it, I didn't realize that it was a cover. I've just always loved Southern rock. You mentioned the blues influence, and I mean, you don't have Southern rock without blues. So, you know, I love the sound when I first heard the song, and I like the message of, you know, hitting the open highway. It was just kind of one of those songs that made you feel like when you were driving down the highway, you wanted to roll your windows down and maybe put your foot on the gas a little more than you probably ought to. So I like that vibe. I was naturally right on board for cutting this song. I kind of felt like that was right in my wheelhouse, and it was, you know, a part of who I am musically that I hadn't had a chance to really put out there yet in working with Sonny and Tony. So I was excited to do so. We went in, we cut the song, and I was very happy with how it turned out. We're in the studio mixing the tracks down, and they mentioned to me, they said, hey, you know, this has actually been released on an album by a band called Blackberry Smoke. And I was like, who? I didn't know who they were. And that makes me the idiot, because I tell you what, I was so excited, you know, that they were kind of pushing me to check out this new band. And I was down in Nashville. I went down to Grimey's record shop and picked up everything that they ever recorded, at least what they had there. Mm-hmm. And I took it back to the house and started listening to it all. And I was like, wow, I really, really dig these guys. So I've now become a huge fan of Blackberry Smoke. And if you haven't heard of them or listened to them, I suggest you check them out if you like Southern rock, because they are a killer group. At the end of the day, I got a great song out of the deal and ended up finding a new band that I really like. So, I mean, what's cooler than that?
Yeah, and now on the other single, I Could Get Used to You. For how was Sonny with the total change? I mean, was he kind of the one that helped implement that, or was that kind of collaborative, if you will?
Well, I mean, the whole idea of making it a reggae, that was absolutely Sonny. When we were going in to cut songs, I had said to him that I wanted to do a cover of this particular number, I Could Get Used to You. It is my wife Amanda's favorite Exile song. So I was like, you know, I really want to do this song. It would be special for her, but I don't want to do a carbon copy of what you guys have already done. You've already done the definitive cut on it. It's the one everybody knows. You had a number one record on it. So I kind of want to do something different with it. And Sonny was kind enough to mention that he had worked with a songwriter group that they put out a pretty good record called Selby Mills LaMare. And they had kind of, when they were doing live shows, they would do a little bit of a reggae version of I Could Get Used to You. And he just kind of expanded on that idea, and we kind of worked it all out. And, you know, it's what you hear today. And it's so different from the original, but yet it kind of does maintain some of the feel of the original. It's not so far out in left field that it's unrecognizable, but it definitely was a nice change and made it fun and new.
Yeah. Whenever I first was checking that one out, I listened to the beginning and I was like, it's gotta be what it is. And it starts out. And then as it started getting, I was like, oh, yep, there we are. It's just a little different, but you know, I think that that brings a new life to lyrics a lot of times whenever you change things, the outside up a little bit, right?
Absolutely. And that's what makes it fun. You know, experimenting is a big part of creating music. And, you know, thankfully, everybody that I've worked with has been very open to trying new ideas and experimenting. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, not all the ideas are winners. You know, sometimes you do something and afterwards you go, oh, no. Scratch that, delete it, make sure that never sees the light of the day. That never happened.
I thought that was only me, but Ken, you're making me feel a little better today. That's good.
Well, I'm glad we can do that.
now, Ken, the three singles, the upcoming release of the album, like you mentioned, summer possibly. Where is the best place to keep up with all the music, all the upcoming tour dates as those become available as well?
Well, you can keep track of me on social media. I'm pretty much on the majority of the sites, but my main one that I'm using is Ken Wilber Country on Facebook. You can definitely check us out there. We are on Twitter and Instagram as well, and several other ones. I'll be honest, you know, I kind of feel like in this day and age, you almost need a team of teenagers to come and like tap you on the shoulder, you know, every time some new platform comes out and goes, hey, old guy, you need to get on this thing. So, you know, we're rapidly expanding that. And we do have a website, kenwilbercountry.com. That website is currently being revamped. So if you go to that right now, that's probably not going to work too well. But in the near future, that will be back up and running. And that would be also a good place. And of course, you can check out our music on iTunes and Spotify and Amazon Music and, you know, pretty much all the purveyors of fine music throughout the internet that do the streaming thing. It's there.
All right. Well, Ken, it has been great to have the chance to visit with you today. I truly appreciate you taking some time out. I know we've had to do a little rescheduling with COVID and all that, but appreciate you taking the time, and hopefully we can catch up again real soon.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Well, this sets a legal precedent that should strike fear in the heart of every lazy husband or wife around the world. A woman in Beijing just took her ex-husband to court and demanded compensation for all the housework that she did during the 5 years they were together. She says she took care of their child, did all the housework alone, and her husband, quote, barely cared about or participated in any kind of domestic chores. And she won. The court ordered her ex to pay her $7,700 in, quote, housework compensation, plus $300 per month in support. Well, again, thanks for joining me for this 30th episode in Season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. If you ever have a comment, question, anything else you'd like to know, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at GQ with Cam. If you'd like to help out in the funding for this podcast, feel free to click the support tab and follow the instructions. If you have a special guest idea, email me, gqwithcam@gmail.com. Well, in the episode description, you'll find a link to our merch site. Be sure and check that out. We've got a grand opening special going to be taking place this weekend. We'll share that information in tomorrow's episode. Again, thanks to Brandon Allen for coming up with the tune for Good Questions with Cameron Dole. We're going to let him play us out. Have a great rest of your Thursday. We'll see you tomorrow for episode 31.